A tough man, Eddie. Finally, he was asked to make a tour of our Pacific bases. Eddie and Colonel Hans C. Adamson left for Honolulu with a stopover in Los Angeles so that he could see his mother and brother Dewey. It was October 1942. Eddie was to leave Hickam Field in a Flying Fortress bound for Australia with a stop at Canton Island, just a speck in the Pacific. That plane never made Canton Island. And with that, started a long ordeal for Captain Eddie. James Reynolds, who now lives in Oakland, California, was the radio operator on that ill-fated Flying Fortress.
As near as I remember, it was around 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We knew that we were going to have to find land fairly soon, or we were going to have to set it down in the water. Well, you have roughly 25 ton of airplane. We had bombay tanks that were empty. The wing tanks were nearly empty. And Bill Cherry made one of the finest landings I've ever seen or heard of since. He brought it in tail low, hit the crest of one wave, went into the air again, and then skidded it around to set the body of the plane, the fuselage of the plane, into the trough. When we crashed, after taking to the rafts, we counted up what food we had. We had 4 very anemic Southern California oranges and a package of fish line and hooks that come in a jungle kit on the back of a parachute. We split those oranges up and made them last as long as we could, more for the fluid than anything else. The rest of the time we lived on fish. We managed to catch 2 with the line that had been taken by one of the members. 2 jumped into the raft, being chased by larger fish. And we caught 1 shark, but they were so strong and rancid we couldn't get anywhere near it, even after drying it out. And we managed to catch a few fish that would hide underneath the raft from the larger fish. They were small, 2 inches long. And all of us, Rick included, ate them tail, feathers, and all.
Back here in the United States, Eddie's friends just couldn't believe he had died. Their reaction was much the same as this, expressed by Arthur Godfrey.
Oh, no, not Eddie. He'll be back. Yes, we knew he was all right somewhere. Because, this survival business is lots of luck, yes. But there's also a great deal in the preparation a man makes. The man was... Rick was mentally prepared, if you know what I mean.
And, of course, Eddie wasn't dead. Far from it. During those long hours on the cramped raft, Eddie was unyielding in his firm discipline and, as a result, kept a firm hand on the actions of the others.
Well, he's a shrewd person, very shrewd. He must have been to get where he is today. I don't believe the man is ruthless or would hurt anyone intentionally. But my best description of the man, if you hated him, hated these guts, you'd have to admire him for them. Rickenbacker didn't wander off as much on a tangent as the most of us did in our minds. His mind stayed, I would say, as clear, if not clearer, than the rest of us. One night, Colonel Adamson went over the side to try to end it all. He was the only one hurt in the actual crash, but Rick and myself and one of the others pulled him back in, and I've heard a man get a tongue lashing, and being an old friend of Rick's, Adamson took it, but I'd hate to get one like it myself.
Eddie's discipline throughout those long days and nights of desperation was probably resented by some of the other occupants of the rafts. But he continued to harass them.
I don't believe the man knows the word of fear. He might internally, but Rickenbacker never displayed a element of fear whatsoever. There's only one incident that I remember where Rick was really pushed out of shape was when he caught one of them drinking more water than they should have at the time, because we were on rations, very strict rations. We had no water at all for the first 8 days, and for the remainder of the time, the most we had any one day was a jigger of water, about an ounce of water a day. He told him that the rest of our lives depended on that water. Our water came from catching rainwater in our underclothes, our socks, our pants, our shirts, and wringing them out into a bucket and then taking them into our mouth and mouthing them inside of, through the tubes inside of a Mae West life jacket. So we had very little water the whole period of time out there. And he really laid the law down to him that you ever catch him doing it again, why, it might lead to severe punishment if we were ever picked up. I think all of us were sore at him at one time or another. Rick was a man that kept at you to keep you going, if nothing else. And Lieutenant Whitaker, the co-pilot, said he was going to live just to spite him.
Finally, after 24 days of torture, 24 days of sun, of hunger and of thirst, came an answer to the long hours of prayer. Planes came out of the sky, passed over, then returned, passed over again and left. But they did return, landed, and thus achieved one of the most famous rescues of all time. It was the end of an ordeal. Captain Eddie Rickenbacker tells of the effects of those 24 long days on a raft.
I've often been asked, particularly in recent years, what effect that experience has had, if any, and what it left. Frankly, physically, it has never left anything detrimental or mentally detrimental. Spiritually, it has left a wonderful feeling of the unbelievable, almost. Because when I got back, I found that the world at large seemed interested. That may sound egotistical, but the newspapers showed that there was tremendous interest in the fact that we'd been picked up and rescued, particularly me. And as I analyzed it, it brought to mind the fact that I was merely a symbol in the minds of millions of mothers and fathers, sweethearts and wives, who felt and got the satisfaction out of the fact that I was picked up, that their beloved ones also had a chance to be rescued and would come back. Unfortunately, all of them didn't, but it was a great feeling of hope.
Back to the living came Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, Colonel Adamson, Pilot William Cherry, Co-Pilot James Whitaker, Lieutenant John DeAngelis, the navigator, Private John Bartek, and radio operator James Reynolds. Staff Sergeant Alex Kosmarchik would never return. In the years since that ordeal, Eddie may have become a quieter man, but he still has all of his cocky assurance, big grin, and unshakable faith in the future of the air transport industry in these fledgling years of the jet age.
As a flyer, of course, Rick doesn't fly anymore at the controls. He hasn't for some time. But those controls, those throttles are still in his hand when he sits in one of those airplanes, because he's watching his pilots and almost gloating sometimes. It's almost gloating in the progress that pilots have made, that airlines have made, in the safety, for instance, and in the economy and the convenience of airline flight.
Yes, Captain Eddie is still going strong, and he still flies endless miles along his system, still with the feel of the wild blue sky in his blood.
He's a great, throbbing example of the absolute idiocy of retiring a man just because he's 65 arbitrarily. Great heavenly days, this man will be, this Rickenbacker will go on until one day that brave old pump just quits.
Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, the Iron Eagle, a man still looking to the future as he answers this question put to him by movie star and fellow airman James Stewart.
Captain Eddie, I'm going to ask you a question. We're sort of making this the anniversary question, and we'd appreciate your comments on it. And here's the question. Against the background of Air Force history, what stands out most vividly in your mind, and what do you see as the greatest problem ahead?
Jimmy, it's very simple to me.
Number one, the accomplishment of the men and women of America in achieving the greatest Air Force power, or air power, that the world has ever known in the short span of 50 years, an accomplishment worthy of every man, woman, and child who has played a part in that development. Secondly, the problem of the future is for those of us of the living to impress on those who are to come and to leave behind a heritage and a tradition for them to follow, so that they, in turn, may profit by the mistakes that we have made, by the penalties that we have paid, and the generations of the future may live in peace and happiness.
Captain Eddy, The Iron Eagle. Another in the NBC series, Biographies and Sound. Your guide was Walter O'Keefe. This program was written and produced by Don Cameron, supervised by James L. Holton for NBC News.
This is Dick Sinclair. Nowadays, you can hardly pick up a newspaper without reading something about the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, better known as NATO. But did you ever stop to think why NATO is so important, especially to the United States? Sure, we're a powerful nation, but we still depend on the free countries of Western Europe for a great deal. When it comes to exporting trade, for instance, Western Europe is our best customer, and that's where a lot of our vital raw materials come from, too. As far as the world's total manufacturing production is concerned, America accounts for 40% of it. But combined with Western Europe's 30%, the free world controls 70%. And that isn't all. With Western Europe as a partner, we can share mutual advancements in science and invention, and our seaports and air bases. Now, those are just a few reasons why NATO is so important to the United States. And most important of all, NATO is guarding your freedom.
Biographies and Sound has come to you through the worldwide facilities of the United States Armed Forces Radio and Television Service.